you can host the best backyard barbecue. When you find a professional on Angie to make your backyard the best around. Connect with skilled professionals to get all your home projects done well. Inside to outside, repairs to renovations. Get started on the Angie app or visit Angie.com today. You can do this when you Angie that.
This Ben Jarofsky Show, Benny J. Bonus Interview, is brought to you in part by the International Association of Machinists and Aerospace Workers, Local 126 and District 8, the International Brotherhood of Electrical Workers, Local 9, the International Union of Operating Engineers, Local 150, and the Chicago Federation of Labor. Benny J., take it away.
It's bonus time in the Ben Jarofsky Show, Friday, December 27th. Man, dang. Friday, December 27th.
Happy birthday to my brother, Corey, by the way.
Happy birthday to Corey. And as we do on bonus time, I always like to point out that you can be listening to this anytime because it's a podcast. It's the beauty of a podcast. As we do with all our bonus shows, I ask our distinguished guest to introduce him or herself. So, distinguished guest, introduce yourself.
I'm feeling very distinguished. This is Nick Dumke. Old friend and collaborator of Benny J's.
Yes. And now ace reporter for ProPublica. Let's get the promotion out for the publication or the operation that you work for. Right, Mick?
You'd think that I would know how to do such things at this point in history, but thanks for the reminder, Ben. Yes, I do work as a reporter for ProPublica, nonprofit journalism organization. We do investigative reporting. So thanks.
Mick and I, for many, many years, were collaborators at the Reader. We wrote, I would say, dozens of stories together. I've never actually taken the time to count up all the stories we wrote together. And for many years, we were co-hosts of First Tuesdays at the Hideout. Mick dropped a bombshell earlier this year that he had enough. He was moving on to spend more time with his family. So how's that family time coming, Mick?
Well, you've seen my wife more than I have today since she's in your studio.
Yeah.
I'm working on it, Ben. What can I say? I'm working on it.
All right. Now, I had a whole list of things that I told Mick I wanted to talk to him about as we came to the end of the year. And when I called him up, we're doing this interview by phone. He's not in the studio. But then right before the interview began, it hit me, Mick, that one of the things I had said, I hadn't mentioned to you that that we should talk about is what's in the headlines right now. And that is, finally, Illinois has legalized recreational reefer. Mick and I, very proud of the articles we wrote back in 2011 and 2012. We did several articles pointing out the inequities of the way the marijuana laws were enforced. Everybody smoked it. But basically, only black people got arrested and busted for it. And I like to think we were ahead of the curve on that one, Mick. What do you think?
I think so. People used to make fun of me. I would go to press conferences to try to catch the mayor or the police superintendent at the time. And I remember being teased, mocked in a good-natured way, but nevertheless, given a hard time by other reporters for asking questions about marijuana. One of our colleagues in the business announced at one of these events, Mick Dumke trying to make the world safe for potheads. And, you know, that was, it was funny, but that was honestly the way a lot of people saw it back then. You know, what are you doing? You know, can't you get your hand? It was as if we were trying to get our hands on better reefer for ourselves. That was why we were writing it.
Yeah.
Which the whole point, of course, was that, you know, as middle-class white guys, if we wanted to, we could probably call around and get pretty good stuff ourselves and use it with near impunity, even in public.
Yeah.
And that was not true for everybody. So, you know, that was always my honest answer was, look, if I want to get my hands on some pot, I can do it. And it's really not an issue for me. Whereas for others, you know, this is a very, very public way for law enforcement to try to crack down on, you know, public displays of what they saw as criminality in certain neighborhoods, but not in others.
Yeah, no, it really hit home going to the courthouses throughout the city with you when we were doing those first few stories and just seeing the parade of black defendants being brought before the judge. That woke me up to the reality that this was a very important story. And so I'm really happy that obviously that the state got around to legalizing weed. But I have to say this, Mick, I don't know. I never confessed this to you. Wonder if you had a similar feeling. At some point I had a postpartum feeling like, is this all there is? And then particularly when there was the reefer revolt in the Chicago City Council, when the black alderman of the city council rose up against Mayor Lightfoot and tried to force the city to hire more black people in the business, or at least to farm out some of the permits to black owned companies to sell marijuana. They were talking about having a delay. They had an actual measure that would delay it for 6 months. I was rooting for them. So it's so ironic, Mick. I spent all this time imploring the state to legalize marijuana. They finally listened to us. They legalized it. And then I said, no, delay it.
Well, and you and I, of course, are not policymakers, but I think we tried to do our jobs as journalists to highlight this issue and get people talking about it. And, you know, we succeeded in our own modest way. And you're right. Now, flash forward to 2018, 2019, I had mixed feelings as well. And mine were similar to yours, some of the same particular issues, that this has always been, for you and I, an issue of social equity and fairness. And then to see the way it's unfolded, where there are going to basically be people who are, you know, who have money, who have resources. They were the only ones who were able, for a number of reasons, to get into the medical business. You need startup funds. You can't go to the traditional banking or loan route for something that is still considered an illegal activity at the federal level. Mm-hmm. And so for a number of reasons, you know, it's basically all, I think you take away the basically, it's all white people who are involved in the businesses that are poised to open on January 1st. Now, there's a whole detailed, complicated discussion. People like our ongoing longtime acquaintance, Christian Mitchell, who now works in the administration of J.B. Pritzker, I've seen some of the things he's responded about, you know, the way he's responded to the city council's Black Caucus moves, attempts to try to slow things down. He's saying, well, you know, we worked really hard on the social equity part of this. This is built in. There is still stuff to be seen. Don't mix up, you know, the start with this, with the way it's going to be set up for the whole time it's in place. Okay, point well made. But you're right, Ben. Some of the same concerns we had all along remain concerns. In addition to that, just speaking, you know, in broad generic terms, you know, do either you and I believe that the state of Illinois won't screw this up in some way? Yeah. I mean, what is the track record here of other so-called vices that have been legalized? Look at the lottery. That was supposed to all be education funding. And we can go on down the list.
Yeah, and I have to say, I pointed this out on the air and in a column. The Christian Mitchell, Toy Hutchinson, Governor Pritzker, Mayor Lightfoot, all these prominent people in the state of Illinois were urging the aldermen in Chicago, the black aldermen in Chicago, to drop their measure, to not to in any way delay their implementation of the law. We must. It's imperative. They all, as one said, we must have the shops open January 1st so the money can pour in. Any delay is absolutely, it's going to hamper this program. We're depending on this money, et cetera, and so forth. I had a laugh, Mick, because when it came to dealing with the real painful inequities of the war on drugs. It was always like, what's the rush? What's the hurry? Nobody was in
Let's slow down. Let's make sure we get this right.
Yeah.
We can't just rush into something we don't know anything about. People could be hurt, of course.
Yeah.
But I would say, the only thing I would say about that is just to add to it is there were people moving to stop this process in the name of social equality within the Black caucus, who I remember being on the record against legalization altogether, okay? So everyone has shifted. I shouldn't say everyone. A large number of people have shifted over just the last couple of years on these different issues.
Yeah.
And so I think what we can safely conclude is the politics of pot remains in evolution, as it has been since we've been writing about this.
Yeah, no, I remember the politicians when we were first search those quotes. Most of them didn't even want to go on the record. They could not figure out a way to deal with this issue in a public manner. So they mostly just pretend it was non-existent. And then off the record would tell you, yeah, I got high last weekend. You know, it was the contradictions and the hypocrisies mix were a little too much to take. But I should move on. I should let it go. It's now legal. They finally did the right thing. And I should be able to accept victory. How about that? You know what I'm saying? Just accept it. We were on the right side of something there.
Yeah, your wife and your therapist would probably tell you the same thing. Be happy with the small victories when you get them.
Right? All right.
Small and large victories. I don't want to claim this is a small victory, but it's definitely a sign that things can change in politics, in people's social views. And I find that part of it actually the most encouraging of all, setting aside the specifics of the policy. I was never out there rooting for a particular policy outcome. I don't know the best way to implement this or anything like that. But the fact that people can finally look at evidence, think things over, and decide maybe it's time to change, that I find very encouraging.
All right. And by the way, a lot more work needs to be done in this to deal with the social inequities. And I'd like to say, I don't know if you saw this, but my beloved hometown of Evanston has a program on it. It's where a portion of the tax that they slap on the sale of recreational weed will be going for social equity programs, like providing more mortgages for Black people in Evanston. So it is possible to use this, I think, in a positive way. Let's hope people emulate Evanston. All right, let's move on to the next item that I wanted to talk to you about. We're almost a full year in to the reign of Lori Lightfoot, Mayor Lori Lightfoot. I did not see this coming in any way, Mick. We're at the end of the year, and I'm thinking back to where I was about a year ago. Well, I did not see Lori Lightfoot emerging in the primary to be one of the top two contenders, you know, to survive the first round of the election. So I have to say I was completely caught off guard by her victory. What about you? Did you were you caught off guard as well?
I was, especially if you think about it as sitting here today versus sitting here a calendar year ago. It's kind of unfathomable. But of course, that's not how things work. Things work in various stages, right? So there were a lot of events that happened that led up to her surge at the polls, most notably the raids of Ed Burke's offices at the end of 2018, right? And the, you know, the slow, steady drip of who else Ed Burke has political ties to, fundraising ties to, whatever, who else was tainted by all of that steady drip, most notably Tony Preckwinkle. So I think nobody saw it. I mean, if anybody tells you they saw it, I think I just find that very hard to believe. But, you know, if you look at, you know, after Ed Burke's indictment, after all the bad press Tony Preckwinkle got, all the stumbles she had, and then you sit here and you say a few months later, are you surprised that it wasn't Tony Preckwinkle? If you think about it that way, well, maybe it's a little less surprising. But you're right. This person, Lori Lightfoot, that many, not only many Chicagoans, but many Chicago voters didn't know much, if anything, about, and now she's mayor. Yeah, that's an astounding story. Now, I will say it hasn't been a full year. It hasn't been close to a full year since she's been in office. She was sworn in at the end of May, so she's really been in for about 7 months. So we don't even have a full calendar year of her tenure yet. Maybe, Ben, it feels like more than a year for you.
Does.
I'm not sure, but...
It seems like she's been mayor for a long time. What's your thoughts about the tone, tenor, and substance of those 7 months under Mayor Lori Lightfoot?
I think, in fairness to Mayor Lightfoot, I know you like to laugh whenever I say, and to be fair, I think it's been pretty up and down. I mean, I think she blasted out of the gate declaring she was going to set a new tone and has tried to follow through in a few campaign promises via... executive order, most notably reining in some of the day-to-day unilateral powers that aldermen have over their wards. But many of the other promises, and there were a long list of them that she made during the heat of the campaign, have not been not only not been fulfilled yet, but she has gone back on them. And I also think that while she is very clearly established that she's not Rahm Emanuel, and many among the electorate, including perhaps you, are pretty happy about that, I also think people are getting used to her own style. I mean, you know, Lori is quite a character herself. She is very sharp, very smart, oftentimes blunt. She's also can be really prickly. And you once, I remember, described Tony Preckwinkle, Lori's vanquished foe in the mayoral race, as utterly humorless. I'm wondering if you're willing to say that about Lori. I mean, you and I interviewed her live at the Hideout, and she showed a lot of personality, a lot of pizzazz, had some good one-liners. But gotta say, since she's been in office, I mean, I'm not saying the job is terribly fun, but I don't think she's shown that much of her personality, that side of her personality, since she's been in office. What do you think?
Well, you reminded me of the Hideout show. I remember one moment where I thought, oh, this Lori Lightfoot could be a breath of fresh air in the city of Chicago. And it came when I can't remember. I think the question had to deal with. It was Tony Preckwinkle's and her campaign was raising the notion that Lori Lightfoot's life began and ended when she became a corporate lawyer. And that's all she was a corporate lawyer. So they tagged her with that label, corporate lawyer. You remember this? And so,
of course,
do
yeah.
you want to elect Chicago a corporate lawyer or a cop? And other people said a cop. And so it was a shorthand way of sort of making her into a stereotype, putting her into a box so it would be easier to dismiss her, marginalize her. And so I asked some variation. That theme was part of a question I asked in one variation or another. I can't remember what it is. And she smiled and said something along the lines, I am going to treat that as though it were a serious question. And that was and people laughed. And it was a very disarming way of saying, I think that's a BS question. The accusation's ridiculous and absurd, but I know I have to deal with it. And so then she went on to say that I was born in Ohio. She gave a rendition of her life that she trots out a lot when she's under threat. You know, she gave up a working class family and black family in rural Ohio, et cetera, and so forth. So it's not like she, you know, came onto earth and was immediately a corporate lawyer. She had a real life experience before this, and that
right.
is a much a part of who she is as being a corporate lawyer. So I said, well, this is I liked the way she answered the question. I thought she was disarming. I thought she was funny. I didn't think she was arrogant. So I liked that about her, and I was hoping I would see more of that as mayor of the city of Chicago. What I've seen a lot of, Mick, not that sense of humor, but which you call bluntness, a little bit of nastiness, you know, quick to turn on people who are opposing her, marginalizing them, demonizing them, which she, some of the things she said about Jason Ervin, the chairman of the Black Caucus in the city council who led the opposition or who led the call for delaying the implementation of reefer law, showed that she kind of took the issue personally. So I was a little disappointed. I wish I had seen more of the Lori Lightfoot that we saw on stage. And also on substantive matters, when she was on the stage with us, I don't know if you remember this, we were asking her about the Lincoln Yards development deal. I mean, the hideout's right in the middle of it all. And she point blank said she was against it. And then she did very little to kill it. And then when there was a lawsuit that was intended to kill it, and when she was the mayor, she sent in city lawyers to fight that. So I have to admit, I wish Mayor Lightfoot was more like candidate Lightfoot, at least the candidate Lightfoot that was on the stage of the hideout.
Yeah, well, I think that's the classic story, isn't it? People campaign one way, then they get in office and they do something else. Now, if we're going to be as generous as possible, you can say that perhaps she was earnest when she was speaking to us on the hideout and she was answering questions on the stump, and she got into office and, you know, learned how it really worked, and she decided she had overpromised some things. That is the danger, I think, of having a candidate who's never held elected office before. I mean, you know, we're in an era where everyone wants fresh faces, but then they get in there and you realize, well, this person actually doesn't really know what he or she is doing. You know, it doesn't mean they can't learn, but, you know, 7 months in, I think she's still trying to find her footing.
Yeah.
And you're right. I think the one thing that has surprised me a little bit is that, especially in contrast to her campaign style, I mean, she ended up becoming a pretty good campaigner, Ben.
Yeah.
You know, she was a novice campaigner, too, a first-time candidate. And she ended up being pretty good on the stump, as we were describing. I mean, you know, really coming across as a human being. Someone who's very smart, someone who had a story to tell that wasn't typical. You know, she's not from Chicago. She didn't pretend that she, you know, she didn't present some sort of false credentials about being from Chicago or whatever. She told us she's from Ohio. This is her story. So really kind of a shift. And I thought she ended up performing very well. She just was a good campaigner, especially by the end. But, you know, it's a lot different to be a campaigner than to be a politician, let alone a governing official. And so I think the transition from campaigner to public politician in under the spotlight every single day, I think if we're going to be as charitable as possible, I think she's still figuring it out. And that's where some of that prickly stuff comes in. I mean, there's opportunities to have a little fun once in a while. It's a tough job, but you could still have fun. And just to be personable, to be a little bit, let your guard down a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
And instead, I feel like she's, in certain instances, as you mentioned, gone out of her way to kind of stick the knife in and twist a little bit in ways that weren't necessary. I know in her first, remember her first city council meeting, she basically told Ed Burke to sit down and shut the F up in as many words.
Yeah.
And we all know that that was a bit of a public performance to try to let everybody know who was in charge. But she's continued to sort of, she says things that are just like kind of unnecessary put downs once in a while, from my viewpoint. Maybe she's got a strategy for it. Maybe that is who she is and she's being as authentic as possible. I don't know. But, you know, that part of it, I guess I've been a little bit surprised.
Well, I got to tell you, I did not see this coming. Based, again, going back to the hideout performance, one of the things I remember we asked her about. The Chicago Teachers Union. The Chicago Teachers Union at the time was engineering commercials or helping pay for commercials that were really hitting her hard and I think unfairly, as much as I love the Chicago Teachers Union. And And so I can't remember if it was you or I, one of us asked her, you know, how she was going to deal with the teachers union when all was said and done. Was she going to hold a grudge against them? And I don't know if you remember, Mick, but she said, no, I will not hold a grudge. I understand that this is an election and things are said in elections that we perhaps don't really mean. And when it's all said and done, we move on. I'll govern and respect the teachers union, respect Karen Lewis, et cetera, and so forth. I haven't seen that side of her, particularly in anyone who dares to cross her gets a 1-2 punch right back, including the Chicago Teachers Union. So I think we're seeing the real deal with Lori Lightfoot.
That may be. That may be just how she rolls. And I certainly get the impression that she and her team came away from the second round of balloting. They won 60% of the vote, and they really came away saying, people voted for Lori Lightfoot, we're going to give them Lori Lightfoot. Yeah. And they really felt that they had a very strong mandate, and that's a high percentage. I didn't see her winning by that margin. I don't know about you. On the other hand, Ben, I got to say, I think it's a mistake to interpret that as an outpouring of energy and, massive support for Lori Lightfoot specifically. I think it was a rejection of Tony Preckwinkle and what people concluded that she stood for as much as it was an embrace of Lori Lightfoot. And so we'll see what that ends up meaning down the stretch, but you saw a little bit of that, I think, in the teacher strike, the lead up to the teacher strike, the negotiations. And by the way, you and I have discussed this offline many times. I certainly didn't put all of the strike at Lori Lightfoot's feet. I think that what you're saying about the grudge was very much two-sided in that instance. There were some very serious and important issues on the table. That goes without saying, but it also really felt very personal from both sides as an observer, a distant observer from where I sat. But you're right. I mean, this is where Lori is right now, and she doesn't want to take any nonsense. And when she's irked at somebody, she doesn't hide it. I just don't, and that's fine. That's her prerogative. I don't know how well that's going to sell going forward. I think that Rahm Emanuel's very dismissive style of critics, I think, wore thin really quickly. So I don't know. Maybe people like Lori Lightfoot. Maybe they believe in her and her policies more than they ultimately did with Rahm. But I think that was one of the reasons Rahm became so unpopular, was his style as much as his policy.
Well, I'll go one step further. Lori Lightfoot did have a mandate. Lori Lightfoot won, I believe, 75% of the vote against Tony Preckwinkle. 75% of the vote, Mick. That's a commanding victory. She won every single ward in the city, I believe. I think she even won the fourth ward, Tony Preckwinkle's home ward. So she had a greater mandate, I think, than Mayor Daley did in his last election. I don't think Daley got 70. Maybe he did. I don't know. I can't remember anymore. But she got a commanding mandate. Whenever I say this, my friends of the leftist persuasion quickly point out that roughly 65% of the people didn't vote. So,
well, that's always the case, yeah. Though. I mean, it's fine. I just disagree with you a little bit that I think there was a mandate, as much of a mandate to vote against Tony Preckwinkle as there was to vote for Lori Lightfoot. But you're right. The end result was the same, is that people overwhelmingly said, we want, this is the choice we're going to make.
Yeah.
So, we'll see. We'll see if the goodwill lasts. I mean, again, it seems longer, but she's only been in office for about 7 months.
All right. Now, speaking of politicians who do not have a mandate, Donald John Trump, he, in contrast to Lori Lightfoot, he didn't even win the popular election. He lost. He got to be the president anyway. I'm not going to ask you to go on and on about Electoral College. Maybe we'll do that deep dive another time. And here we are as we come into 2020, Mick. He's being impeached. I know you don't cover national politics on a regular basis, but like me, you share an obsession with presidential politics. And your thoughts about the impeachment of Donald Trump, as opposed to the impeachment that you lived through, the impeachment of Bill Clinton, similarities, contrasts, themes, and et cetera, and so forth?
Well, I guess the similarities are that it feels very partisan, although it's far worse now than it was in, was he impeached in 1998? Was that the year? It was middle to late in his second term.
Mm-hmm.
And of course the party's roles were essentially reversed at that time. And I think the other similarity to me, the strongest case in both instances was obstruction of justice, was just simply the fact that no one is above the law. And in Clinton, to me, that was really the only compelling argument. I didn't like the personal behavior of Bill Clinton. I never thought that rose to an impeachable offense. But it was perhaps more convincing the fact that he eluded the truth. You know, he didn't tell the truth. He lied. Let's just come right out on it. Fudged around the truth. Didn't disclose the information and basically tried to weasel out of it. Even on that ground, I think, if we're going to contrast them, I think Donald Trump and his administration have behaved far worse. I mean, they have not responded to congressional subpoenas. That alone, to me, is deserving of removal from office. It's, you know, you're supposed to be the highest official following the law in the land, and it's like a, you know, basic government principle, the separation of powers, and he's not respecting congressional authority in the least, turning his nose up at it, propagandizing against it. I find that to be, that in itself is a compelling reason to go forward with the impeachment process.
The comparison with Nixon, now you were a wee lad, you weren't following it in real time, but I know you have an obsession of sorts with Nixon, and you've read a lot about it and seen all the movies, et cetera, and so forth. How do you contrast those two cases?
Well, I think that it started off perhaps similarly, that I think is my understanding of history is that initially many, if not most, Republicans rallied around Nixon and tried to minimize the severity of the charges against him. But the difference, of course, was that a lot of Republicans along the way became disgusted by the behavior of Nixon and his cronies. There are many attempts, again, to obstruct the inquiry. He fired a special prosecutor. And unlike now, the stark contrast is we have now the leader of the Senate, Mitch McConnell, coming right out and saying that he's coordinating with the White House and that there's no chance that the impeachment will go forward. I mean, there's basically saying that there's no chance there will be a trial or anything resembling a credible inquiry in the Senate. Whereas there were a group of Republican senators who, in the end, went to Nixon and told him, it's over.
Yeah.
And that precipitated his resignation. I believe it was Barry Goldwater and a couple other senators, Barry Goldwater, the previous, really the leader of the conservative wing of the Republican Party, right, who went to Nixon and told him or called him, contacted him and said, listen, it's over. You should get out of it while you can. And I think he had been contemplating whether it was time to go already, but that was kind of the final straw. So you had some Republicans who at that time who did what they thought was the in the best interest of the country above party. And right now it's just everything is so divided by the parties. You're not going to see, it doesn't look like any Senate Republicans who are going to do anything comparable.
No, or Senate congressmen. And I just this weekend saw the movie Bombshell, which talks about sexual harassment cases at Fox News and Roger Ailes. And I have to tell you, Mick, that the creation of Fox News and the way it's acting as like a rallying, like a cheerleaders for Donald Trump, has destroyed any hope that there would be like a bipartisan, cooperative spirit here, and it, so it. I always say this, that it really does remind me of the Johnny Cochran tactics in the O.J. Simpson trial, where it's just you take anything you can that would undercut the credibility of the prosecution and use it against it and amplify it. So you're effectively putting the prosecution on trial, which is what Johnny Cochran did. And it's so ironic that many of the people who are now doing this on behalf of Trump are yelling the loudest against Johnny Cochran and denouncing him in real terms. And so I'm at the stage, Mick, I don't know if you've reached this stage, where I feel it is hopeless. The notion of bipartisan spirit in this country is hopeless. I've been spending a lot of time lately reading books about the early years of Obama and his administration, and how he always would hearken to this notion of a bipartisanship, which was not existent then, Mick.
Of course.
But he pretended as though it did, and Democrats invested into that delusion and that dream, and it's shattered now. You're absolutely correct. The way you position that was, it's a defiance of Congress. So you would think that Republicans would join in with their Democratic colleagues to defend their institution. And instead, they're attacking their Democratic colleagues and cheering on Trump as he defies it. So to me, that is
a bit of a head scratcher. It's like, to briefly circle back to local politics for a second, how you and I have discussed many times, why are members of the Chicago City Council traditionally so eager to give away their power to the mayor? It's a similar kind of thing where you have now members of Congress defending someone who is defying them. Don't they realize that at some point in time, and it may be sooner, it may be later, at some point in time, these roles are again going to be reversed. It's going to be Republican leaders of Congress trying to get information, conduct investigations of a Democratic administration. And there's a precedent now for just, using propaganda and attacking their motives, questioning their motives, and ignoring the law. So you're absolutely right. To me, all the charges about Ukraine, they're very serious. Let the experts handle all that stuff. To me, just taking a half step back, this is the thing that really troubles me. It's just, if we're supposedly a nation of laws, and you have one of the political parties basically justifying breaking the laws, breaking even the traditions within their own body for purely partisan reasons. And of course, they're saying that the Democrats are purely partisan in their impeachment inquiries. It just doesn't end well, because it's just, you can remove this guy from office, and it's just, we're going to go through another cycle. I don't know. That's the thing that bothers me the most, because Trump, at some point in time, whether it's, a year and a half from now, or whether it's, 5.5 years from now, we'll be out of office. But I don't see how all this stuff ends.
No, it's not going to end well. All right, let's end this segment on a completely different topic. Dennis is always telling me I'm not allowed to talk sports, but it's the end of the year, so let's do a little sports summary. And people may not know this about Mick Dumke. He's a big sports fan. He loves football, loves Northwestern football. And he's a Chicago Cubs fan. He's a Chicago Bears fan. He's lately developed a bizarre fondness for my beloved Chicago Bulls, a real cry for help.
I'll admit, my Bulls, I love the Bulls, but my attention span is fickle with the Bulls. I'll admit it. I mean, like everybody else, was a rabid fan, didn't like to miss any games, during the golden era of the 90s. And then recent years have been a little flakier, fewer reasons to watch. You get attached to a good player, they ship him out. No strategy for rebuilding or success. It's just been frustrating to be a fan. So I kind of shifted more of my attention to college basketball, which I also love. But you're right. This year, for whatever reason, I just decided, you know what the heck? I'm just gonna get into them. I'm just gonna stick with them through thick and thin, through a couple surprising victories along the way, and many late game collapses. And you know what, Ben? I'm still with them.
I find them very
enjoying some of these young players.
I'm enjoying it. I will make a revelation about Mick that he probably doesn't want anyone to know. He was texting me excitedly when Zach LaVine scored the 49 points against Charlotte. Can you believe it? I was in a restaurant. I'm getting texts from Mick. I'm like, man, slow night at the Dumpke house. He's watching. All right. So here's the question I ask every sports fan that comes on the show, and it is this. In my humble opinion, the 2019 Chicago Bears are one of the most disappointing teams in the history of Chicago sports. So much was expected of them, and so little was delivered, beginning with the opening day loss to Green Bay on national TV, which was hands down the most disappointing loss of the 21st century by a Chicago sports team, closely followed by the Chicago Bulls loss in Game 6 in 2015 to the Cleveland Cavaliers, where they just quit. They gave up. All right. That said, here's the question for you, Mick Dumpke. Don't duck and dodge. Was Ryan Pace's decision to trade up to draft Mitch Trubisky as his quarterback when he had Patrick Mahomes there for the taking, was that the worst decision in the history of Chicago sports by a general manager? Go.
I will say no, it was not. But that's not to say it was a good decision. How about that? You and I warmed up a little bit offline before we started the show, full disclosure to all of your fans out there. And as I told you then, I will now announce it publicly. I think the biggest debacle by sports management in my lifetime, the one that hurt personally the most, was the series of events that resulted in Greg Maddux leaving the Cubs for the Atlanta Braves after the 1992 season. As just a diehard Cubs fan and somebody who loved Maddux, and I was still relatively young back then, in my early 20s, that one just really stung. And it stung even more for the next 12 years as Atlanta went on to win with Greg Maddux as the leader of that great rotation. They went on to win 14 total division titles in a row, including 12 once Maddux joined the team, while the Cubs just most of that time were sputtering. So that one stings worse. But I did look up the senior year, the final year college stats of if the Bears are going to draft a quarterback, and these are the two guys. The stats really weren't even close between these two guys. Holmes threw for more than 5,000 yards his last year at Texas Tech. And Trubisky, not a bad year, but he had about 3,800 yards that season. And not knowing much about, I am a college football fan, as you noted, Ben. So I do follow this stuff, and I didn't know that much about Trubisky in college, and he only really started for 1 year.
Yeah.
So I'm sure that Pace had some set of reasons, something he saw in Mitch that may still develop and flower. I don't know. But just the basic set of facts I have at my disposal, you have a guy who basically only played every day, every game for 1 year of college, and he had a very good year, but he didn't even have the best year of anybody available, and Mahomes had started for at least a couple years. So he had not only better numbers, but a longer track record at that point in time. So I don't know what he was thinking. The basic information I have available was that that was a bad move. And, of course, in retrospect, you know, it looks even worse.
All right. Well, I'd have to say the worst all-time decision. By the way, the Greg Maddux decision, I have a memory. 1992, I went to the last game of the Cubs. They were playing the Pirates, and Maddux was on the mound. He was pitching effortlessly. It was one of those typical Maddux games. And in left field for the Pirates was Barry Bonds. And he was a free agent. And my friends and I were, oh, man, the Cubs, man, we're going to have Maddux. We're going to – let's go get Barry Bonds. We were, like, thinking the Cubs were actually going to sign Barry Bonds. Well, Barry Bonds went to San Francisco. It's like the Cubs – no, that's too radical to sign, like, the greatest player of his era, right, Mick? Not only that –
okay, what supposed slugger – did they sign instead of Bonds? Do you have any?
No,
this is
I can't
a really
remember.
Obscure trivia question.
I put it out
I
of
only
my...
know because I was just brushing up before we went online
who?
Here. But
who did they sign?
Candy Maldonado.
All right, there you go. There. Okay. So that's running neck and neck. Maddux and Bonds combined running. I still say 21st century, hands down, Ryan Pace, worst decision. Absolutely. It's going to set back the Bears for at least 10 years. They have no quarterback. And it's, you know, there's as a staffer here at the Sun-Times, Mick, I won't mention his name, a huge Bear fan. Whenever I see him in the hallway, I go, Mitch Trubisky, what a draft choice. And he just grumbles and mutters and moans and such. Anyway, terrible draft.
You know what? I'll just throw this out there because I'm a Chicago fan. This is the kind of gut feeling I have, is that if the Bears do not extend Mitch's deal and he goes somewhere else, he'll end up being an excellent quarterback. That's just the feeling I have. Okay?
Yeah, that he'll be like one of those ex-Bulls. This is unbelievable. I talk about this all the time. Like Bobby Portis. When they come back and they play the Bulls, they annihilate the Bulls. Suddenly they're like all, you know, superstars, and then they're thumping their chest, and I'm like, where was this when you were on the team? So you're right.
I know.
Mitch Trubisky will probably come back to Soldier Field and light it up. On the other hand,
we used to call it the baseball season. We call it the ex-Cub factor, right? And now it's. I just feel like it's extended to all Chicago teams. It's incredible.
All right, it's a rough time for Chicago sports, but I have a feeling it'll be a great year ahead. And so, Mick, thank you so much for coming on. I appreciate it. Have a happy New Year. All right.
Thank you. You too, Ben.
All right. That's great, Mick Dumpke. I'm Ben Jarofsky. That's another Ben Jarofsky bonus show. Take care, everybody.